Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in Politics on the New Books Network. I am your host, Bill Scher. Today, we are joined by our first repeat guest. He is a Boston Globe columnist. You might remember our interview with him about his previous book, American Maelstrom, about the 1968 presidential election. His new book is Clear and Present Safety, The World Has Never Been Better and Why That Matters to Americans. Michael A. Cohen, thanks so much for coming back.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, for those who follow your work at the Boston Globe, follow you in social media, you are not a fan of President Donald Trump. You're not sanguine about what he's doing to the country and the world.
That's right.
So what would compel you to write a book about how things aren't so bad?
Well, because I'm an optimist, and I'm not going to let Donald Trump destroy my optimism about global events, I guess is one way to put it. You know, it's a good question, and it's a funny thing about when this book has been something that I've been working on with my co-author Mike Azenko for a couple of years now. And I will be honest that the day after the 2016 election, there were some furtive emails between Mike and myself about what do we do now, because it did seem to undermine some of the arguments in the book. I think it appeared to undermine some of the arguments. But the reality is that we wrote this book because there is a great story to tell about international affairs that frankly has not been told. And that story is that we are living in one of the most extraordinary moments, positive moments in human history, as far as improvements in global living standards. People are living longer lives. People are healthier. They are richer. They have more money. They have more access to education, to healthcare, to clean water, to healthy food, and so on and so forth. So there's all these great positive elements that have happened, and that story is not being told. That story is being overwhelmed by threat mongering and threat inflation that we've seen over the past 20 years. Threat mongering about terrorism, about immigrants. About Iran and North Korea and the rise of China and so on and so forth. So we decided, you know, it was an opportunity. This book is an opportunity to sort of tell the story of what's really happening in a way that I think most people are not aware. And so even the election of Donald Trump can't change the fact that we have this extraordinary developments and these developments that we think have made a huge difference in global affairs and can continue to do so if we have leaders in this country who understand them and are focused on continuing this expansion in human development that we've seen over the past 20 or 30 years.
So what do you attribute the improvement in our daily lives? Is it capitalism? Is it education? Is it international alliances? Is it technology? What would you say is the main reason why things are better today than they were 50, 100, 500 years ago?
I mean, all of the things you mentioned are good examples of the reason why we've seen this progress occur. I mean, certainly, you know, we go back to the end of the Cold War and the this revolution in freedom and political liberalization, and more countries being democratic, in economic liberalization, in expansion of international trade, and economic interdependence, all of which has contributed to a lot of the economic gains that we've seen over the past several decades. But it's also, I think, a factor that you have this a global consensus to a large extent around a lot of issues related to global and human development. And that's a big deal, I think, one that's really underappreciated. You know, we talk a lot in the book about the Millennium Development Goals, which were a series of benchmarks basically put forward by the international community on a host of development issues, on education, on food security, on health. And what we've seen over the past two decades in particular is that global actors, international organizations, states, NGOs, philanthropies have come together to bring progress on a number of these development issues that once seemed intractable. And so one example, just, you know, we talk a lot in the book about threat inflation and how we overemphasize the wrong things in foreign policy. And we talk a lot about the disaster that was the Iraq War and the opportunity costs of that were created by going to war in Iraq and how badly that what a waste of resources, I should say, that war represented. And of course, a tragic, you know, waste of human life that all those who were killed during the war. But one thing we point out is that one of the positive aspects that came out of the whole sort of war on terrorism mindset was the PEPFAR program, which was the Bush administration's efforts to deal with the HIV/AIDS crisis. And what turned out was a very rather small investment of $15 billion. Relatively speaking, I mean, $15 billion is not a small amount of money, but compared to what we spent in Iraq and Afghanistan, it is a small amount of money. But that $15 billion has helped lead to this extraordinary decline in HIV and AIDS deaths. We're living now through a 12-year decline in deaths. Actually, I think it's even more than 12 years. I have to look at the numbers, but more than a dozen years of a decline in AIDS deaths, HIV and AIDS deaths. That's a huge issue that's changed lives for millions, tens of millions of people around the world. And it was done with, again, you know, a small investment by the United States, but also cooperation by states, by NGOs, by international organizations that work together to sort of make this positive change possible. And, you know, it's not just, you know, in HIV/AIDS. It's also things like tuberculosis prevention, which has saved something like 50 million lives. Measles immunizations, which apparently everyone but in Los Angeles and in the Pacific Northwest understand, and I should say in where I live in New York, understands this is important. It's decreases in malaria. You've seen diseases that once killed, you know, millions of people are in some cases been wiped out. Things like polio, things like guinea worm, which was a disease that once affected like, you know, 3.5 million people in the developing world. Basically, by last year, there was one reported case in the world. So we're seeing this extraordinary improvement and increase. And I think one thing the book that's important to us for talk about is that these are the kind of stories we should be focusing on and also thinking about how do we continue to ensure this progress continues. And too often, when we talk about foreign policy, we talk about you know, nuclear weapons, we talk about terrorism. We don't talk about the progress that we've made and on human development and the ways that we can continue the progress.
You know, one of the tricky elements of the sort of perennial half glass, half full, glass half empty argument is if you're focusing on the positive as you're doing right now, some will charge. This is sort of a classic, you know, white privilege take. There's all sorts of terrible things happening in the world. There's still plenty of crushing poverty, plenty of disease, erosion of worker rights and human rights. So by focusing on the positive, you're removing the urgency to deal with what's still negative in the world. But I suppose the flip side is if you don't focus on the positive at all, you can't learn the lessons of how you've gotten as far as you have come. So how do you square those that tension in the book?
Well, your last part's exactly right, that if you don't focus on the positives, it's hard to know how you can make progress going forward. And I think one reason that we talk about these positive developments is understand that problems that seem intractable to us today, you know, once seemed intractable 20, 30 years ago and have to a large extent been progress has been made on them. One rejoinder that we get a lot about the book is on the issue of climate change. And for obvious reasons, And, you know, it is obviously a problem that is greater than anything we've ever seen, especially in environmental issues, but also is one that I think could wipe out a lot of the positive changes that we've seen happen over the past several decades. But one thing that I remind people is, I may be dating myself when I say this, but I remember when I was a kid, we talked about the ozone hole. The ozone layer was basically, there's a hole developing in the ozone layer, you know, over the South Pole, and this was going to create huge global problems if this wasn't dealt with. And it was sort of talked about in very alarmist terms, and for good reason. It was a big problem. And yet the international community came together, eliminated what known as the use of chlorofluorocarbons, which was contributing to the ozone hole. And as a result, the ozone hole has basically been filled up. There is not this problem that we thought 30 years ago was going to be this incredible crisis for humanity has largely been resolved. So I it's important just to understand that problems that, again, we thought we couldn't solve, we have found ways to deal with. I mean, the HIV/AIDS crisis 20 years ago, I think there was a lot of sense that this was a epidemic that was out of control. And we've seen extraordinary progress in how we've dealt with this issue, not just in the United States, but around the world. But I want to get back to what you said a second ago, which I think is really interesting, the white privilege argument. Our argument that Mike and I are making is a white privilege argument. I would say the opposite is true. People who dispute what we're talking about, they're the ones who are sort of exhibiting the white privilege here, if you want to use that expression. Because in a way, it is minimizing this extraordinary progress that you've seen in what is, for the most part, developing countries, right? I mean, in virtually every developing country in the world, you have seen huge progress in raising global living standards and getting more people to go to school, more women to go to school, more girls to go to school. You've seen huge progress in wiping out diseases. I mean, the thing is, and I think one reason why some people don't want to talk about this is because the way this has happened is through things like increased trade, through increased economic interdependence. The things that supposedly people complain about and say contribute to inequality are also the things that have led to this increase in global living standards. So one thing that's happened recently, there's this bizarre debate going on now. People are saying, we've seen this decline in poverty, that basically 30 years ago, half the developing world lived in poverty. Today, the number is less than 10%. That is, to me, the most extraordinary story in international affairs in the last 25 years. I mean, just an incredible, seminal transformation in the human experience. And you have people now who are writing pieces for The Guardian, other places, that are basically saying, this isn't really happening, that these numbers are wrong, and that, you know, we should look at poverty in a different way, and we should assess the numbers differently. And I think this has become like a way to dispute this progress. And I think it's being done by people who have an agenda. And that agenda is to push back on sort of what they call the neoliberalist sort of approach to global affairs. The people who don't like globalization, don't like trade. And so one way to sort of push back on that is to say all this progress that is the result in many ways of greater interdependence and greater trade is not really happening. And so I do think that this argument is not the white privilege argument. This argument is actually the opposite of that. And I think it's one that I think a lot of people should, I think people on the left are not taking seriously enough.
So you mentioned this debate between, some on the left and so-called neoliberalism. Often there are critiques that the push towards globalization, the push towards lowering international trade barriers don't serve to help the poor in the world, that those rules have been written to benefit multinational corporations and to erode workers' rights and erode environmental protections and so forth. Are you arguing in the book that is wrong and that, I mean, I don't know if you embrace the term or the philosophy of neoliberalism, but are you arguing that what those on the left criticize actually has its merits?
Yes. I mean, I think that, you know, there's a strain on, I think, on the people who are sort of optimists, who I think argue, sort of dismiss some of the claims of income inequality which certainly has increased globally over the past several decades. There's no question about that. I don't think, you know, I think that we don't fall into that camp necessarily. I mean, I think we're sort of very cognizant of the fact that some of the these improvements have created the negative consequences from some of these developments, in the sense of inequality being one very good example of that. And also that some of this progress has stalled. There's no question about that also, that in places where, like China, for example, where you've seen extraordinary increases or decreases in poverty rates, you're now seeing, which was, by the way, the result of just, amazing growth rate that were sort of in part manufactured by the state itself. You've seen sort of as those growth rates have declined somewhat, moves toward authoritarianism, greater authoritarianism in China and other places as well. So I think there are sort of negative things to look at here. But I do think in general the story here, and I hate the word neoliberal, by the way, because it's basically an epithet for anybody who disagrees with people. Like on the left, I think it's become an epithet for people who don't agree with them; they're just neoliberals. It's become a term, a sort of catch-all term of insult. I think in general, though, it's really hard to argue that the direct trade agreements, trade liberalization, globalization has contributed to a lot of what the progress that we write about in the book. I don't think any question about that. Not that there's not a downside to some of that, but I think that by and large, there's a positive story here. And I think that that makes me a neoliberal. Fine, makes me neoliberal. I mean, that's how you want to call me. I'm not going to stop you. Someone wants to label me that. But the facts are the facts. And I think one frustration I have about some of the trade debates that we see in this country is that we only focus on sort of the losers in trade, and we don't focus on the people on the extraordinary positive developments that come from trade. There are lots of communities in this country that have benefited extraordinarily from trade. There are whole industries that exist now that didn't exist 20 years ago because of increased international trade. And we should be focusing on the communities that are hurt, the people who have been the losers in this process. But we shouldn't ignore the positive aspects of international trade. And I look at something like, the TPP issue and the fact that you had, not just Republicans, but Democrats who opposed it. And the result of that
Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement that Obama had negotiated, but Trump pulled out of upon being inaugurated.
Right. Thank you. And I just would add to that, he did pull out of it. But if you remember that during the 2016 campaign, Hillary Clinton said she would do the same thing. And I think that sort of animosity toward trade that is focused mainly on trying to win over voters in Midwestern states really ignores the positive aspects of trade. And has ended up hurting American businesses, but also hurting American consumers. And I think that that is something that is, I think, very unfortunate. And also is a result of that we don't have a conversation about trade that looks at both sides of the equation. We have a conversation about trade that basically looks at the negative side and not the positive side.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Now, Hillary Clinton turned on TPP under pressure from her primary challenger, Bernie Sanders, because there was a lot of antipathy towards trade liberalization on the left. But it's Donald Trump that ended up benefiting from that sentiment upon winning the election. And upon his inauguration, you've had a spate of books talking about erosion of basic democracy, the most famous being How Democracies Die. and Trump is often looked upon as a figure who is talking up strongmen like Kim Jong-il, being favorable to Vladimir Putin, being bullying free press in America. And along with that, there's been an increased concern about political polarization, making it hard to find common ground and also contributing to a sense of democratic norms and governmental stability. So if I can circle back a bit to what you were saying about the ozone layer and climate, this seems to be a big debate about. So you acknowledge that climate change is one of our most pressing concerns, and not the most pressing concern, even though regardless of what improvements have been made in society. The ozone layer problem was solved through with a Republican president who could find bipartisan support in America and reach out on the global stage and win international support for a solution. Is that kind of solution possible with our current state of affairs, with deepening polarization and weakening alliances around the world?
It's possible, but not if Donald Trump remains president. I mean, I think it's an easy way to put that. I mean, I think that this is one of the reasons why we're also concerned. And we say this in the book. I'm glad you asked this question, because I didn't want your listeners to think that I'm too Panglossian in my view of international affairs, because, there has been this decline in democracy over the past now decade or so. That is very worrisome, because one of the reasons why we've seen so much progress over the past 20, 30 years is because of this expansion in political freedom, expansion in democracy. Democracies tend to be, they tend to embrace economic liberalization. They tend to be better on issues like the environment. They tend to actually do things for their citizens. And that's one of the reasons why we had such improvement on these global development metrics. The decline in democracy, it's evident around the world. You've seen countries that are authoritarian become more authoritarian, like China and Russia, and to some extent Turkey. Countries that were democracies become a move in the wrong direction, and like Poland and Hungary and the Philippines. And in the U.S., you've certainly seen this step back from, America's still a democracy, but it's less democratic than it was, 3 years ago or 2.5 years ago. That has a cascading effect. And one of the places is on environmental issues. And you bring this up, but certainly the decision by Trump to pull out of the Paris climate deal, the step back on environmental regulation, all of these things have contributed to the worsening of the climate change problem and make it harder, as you say, to find international consensus on this issue. It's interesting because there is a great deal of international consensus on the need to deal with climate change. I mean, the biggest outlier is the United States. And actually, if I'm being more specific, the biggest outlier is the Republican Party in the United States. It's harder to make progress on an issue like that because of this. And I think this is something that I think voters should think about in 2020. I mean, if you want progress on climate change, you're not going to get it if you have Donald Trump is in the White House. It's just a fact. I would say also that Trump remaining in office undermines so many of the elements that have led to this improvement in the human condition we talk about in the book. International cooperation, the international system, the consensus that has largely existed with the international system that condemns, cross-border attacks, that tries to uphold the democracy, that works to stop, proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. All of those things are in part a result of an international system, international consensus on these issues. And that consensus has been weakened by this president. So I do think that is certainly, if I would point to one issue, Mike and I would both say the one issue that really concerns us going forward is this deficit, this democracy deficit, and the extent to which that will undermine the progress that's been made over the past several decades.
One thing we do here on New Books in Politics, and by the way, we're talking to Michael A. Cohen, author of Clear and Present Safety, The World Has Never Been Better, and Why That Matters to Americans, co-written with Mika Zenko, published by Yale University Press. we give our New Books in Politics super fans the opportunity to ask questions to the authors in advance. And the one question I got for you was, how do you square your thesis with the proliferation of guns in the U.S. during the past 30 years?
That's a great question. I'm so glad that I got asked that, because one of the things in the book we talk about, and here's the negative side of the story. I didn't want to seem too Panglossian. So the last two questions have helped make sure that I'm not too Panglossian. The negative part of the story is this. While all this progress is being made around the world, the U.S. is moving in the opposite direction. And this is, I think, one of the reasons why I wanted to write the book as well, is that we focus so much in this country on global threats. We focus on terrorism. We focus on weapons of mass destruction. We focus on potential military rivals. But what we argue in the book is we should be focusing on things like guns and drugs and obesity, issues that fundamentally undermine our quality of life in this country. And, you know, it's interesting. This book was something that we had began as an article in Foreign Affairs back in 2012. And when we wrote that, we didn't even mention the drug epidemic because it wasn't, it was a problem, and there was, many Americans were being killed from dying from overdoses. But it wasn't a crisis the way it is today. And of course, now more than 70,000 Americans died last year from drug overdoses, which is almost as many as died from guns and cars combined. And that is, in my view, a national crisis that deserves to be treated like a national crisis, like a national emergency, and is not. And guns is another issue. I mean, 40,000 Americans are killed by guns, I think it was 2017, it was 40,000. It's the highest total in 50 years. And those numbers, are getting worse at a time around the world. Again, gun violence, pales. There's just simply no country that has anywhere near the level of gun violence that we do in this country. And the result of that, it's not just, by the way, the tragedy of lives lost, which of course itself is enough of a tragedy that we should be focusing on this. But there's a larger price we pay for this, which is the economic costs. And when it comes to something like guns, for example, we're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars in healthcare costs, in declining economic productivity that is a result of gun violence in this country. I mean, we talk a lot in the book about health issues. Take an issue like obesity. 40% of Americans are considered obese. That, by the way, is, when we read the article in 2012, it was 32%. So 25% increase in just a 7-year period. The obesity crisis affects hundreds of millions of Americans, but it's also something in which the cost of it are enormous. We're talking about trillions of dollars in healthcare costs, in lost productivity, in declining GDP, from this issue. So, from our perspective, that is an issue that we need to be talking about and dealing with and thinking about as a national security crisis. Because when you have something like guns, something like obesity, which contributes to what are called chronic diseases, like diabetes and cardiovascular disease, those diseases kill more Americans than anything else. So you're talking about, first of all, from a national perspective, talking about issues that kill Americans, but also that undermine our economy, that contribute to healthcare costs, we would argue, erode the foundations of our national power. How can America be a great, powerful country if our own people are dying sooner than they should be, and if we are taking on these enormous costs, in healthcare costs, in public healthcare programs like Medicare and Medicaid, but also what we individually pay in our premiums, and also that undermine our economy. And so, one thing we want people to take away from the book is that we need to rethink, recontextualize national security debates and think about issues like obesity and guns as being national security issues and ones that need as much attention as we would give to a national security crisis like terrorism or Iran's nuclear program or the rise of China.
Now, you mentioned in the book, and this is something I've written about myself, I should note, that the vast majority of gun deaths in America are not these public mass shootings.
That's right.
They are suicides. And related to that, they are at the weapon of choice is not the military assault rifle, it's the handgun. You don't, you don't kill yourself with a military assault rifle. That's more complicated. But our focus on the issue only seems to happen when there is a public mass shooting. So we have this usually multi-day national mourning, which quickly leads into a political polarization, a debate over should we ban guns or not, which never resolves itself. And then after a few days of yelling at each other, we move on to the next national crisis or next news story. And because we don't, because we don't think of the issue as primarily a suicide slash handgun problem, we only talk about it when it's a public mass shooting military assault rifle issue, and then we forget about it in between mass shootings.
Right.
So how can we reorientate our conversation to deal with the majority of the actual gun death issue?
Well, I mean, I think we should just be talking about it. I mean, I think it's, you know, the only way I can think of to me, there's a big public education element to this issue. I think most Americans do not understand that if you bring a gun into your home nominally for protection, the chances that someone in that home will die from gun violence exponentially increase. There's just no other way around it. I mean, the biggest risk factor in dying from gun violence is owning a gun. And I think many Americans do not understand or appreciate the dangers that exist in owning firearms. And, you know, that includes things like accidents, things such as domestic violence, which is a huge factor in gun violence in this country, but also suicide. I mean, as you said, I mean, the majority of gun deaths are from suicides. And America, in suicide rates in America have dramatically increased. So the rest of the world, suicide rates are declining. In America, they're increasing. Now, there's lots of different theories on why this is happening. But one contributing factor, there's no question about it, is the easy availability of guns. And the reason for that is because when someone tries to kill themselves with a gun, the results are often very final and very tragic. It's rare that you try to kill yourself with a gun and you survive. But in most situations, people who try to commit suicide do not kill themselves. In many cases, suicides are a cry for help. They're an attempt to get attention. And so you try to kill yourself with an overdose or slashing one's wrist, something like that, which is awful, obviously. But often people will survive that. But again, with gun violence, they do not. And so I hate to use this word, but it's sort of the way that I think it's described in sort of public health circles. The success rate on suicide is much higher in the United States, and that's largely because of the availability of guns. If we didn't have the same availability of guns that we do, suicide rates would be lower. So that's something I think that's important to keep in mind. And I think I've sort of for a long time thought there needs to be more public education about this, understanding that if you own a gun, you're putting yourself at risk and your family members as well. And so I think I think talking about suicide rates when it comes to guns is really, really important because it is something I think is misunderstood. And I think it's something that if you understood it better, you might have different patterns of gun ownership.
So we've talked a lot about what's not so great in the world, climate crisis, gun crisis, obesity. As a final takeaway for our listeners, what should we take away from the positive of the past century and then some, and how America and the world has improved. What are the lessons to learn to apply to the remaining problems that we face?
You know, it's a good question, and I think the one way I think about this is that our book talks about the success stories and talks about the progress that's been made, but we understand also that progress can be reversed, and I think the election of Trump and sort of the backstep on democracy using a number of countries. I think, places like in the UK with Brexit and in Brazil with the recent election of a right-wing leader, I think all of those suggest that these changes can be undone. And I think, it's important to be vigilant in sort of understanding how much progress we've made. It's important, first of all, to understand the progress has been made. That's the first step, to understand that part. understand how that happened and understand how it will continue and what's the best way to make it continue. And that nothing is written in stone when it comes to, you know, these advances. They can be reversed. So I think that's an important part to understand. And I think, you know, one way to ensure they are not reversed is to have a president who understands the importance of the national system, the importance of international cooperation, the importance of standing up for democracy and human rights. I think the other thing is that, you know, the success that we've seen in things like dealing with the AIDS crisis, you know, closing the ozone hole, you know, getting more girls to go to school, which is such a huge factor in development in developing countries. Those happened because, you know, there was a consensus that existed among a whole host of international actors. These issues were important and they needed to be addressed. And so when people talk about climate change to me, and I, we're not, you know, I would say very clearly, we would say this in the book, that the one issue that could undermine most of the progress that's been made over the past several decades is climate change. But we also would say that the progress that we've made, that, you know, the way that happened is a model for how we deal with climate change. And I think that's really the point to get across here, that we have seen over and over again that global actors can come together and try to solve these problems. We can do the same thing on climate change. It's tougher. I don't want to sugarcoat it. It's more difficult. It's, you know, more actors that are going to be harmed by this, but we have a model for how to make progress on difficult international issues, and we can, the success that we've achieved in other places, we can be achieved in climate change if there is this forthrightness and wherewithal of, you know, certainly this country, of our political leaders to deal with the crisis. So I guess that's sort of the hopeful message, is that, you know, take away from the progress that we've seen, that we know how to do these things. We know how to solve these sort of crises. And hopefully the lessons, the successful lessons that we've seen over the past several decades can be applied to climate change. Because if it's not, then, you know, then a lot of what we've written in this book is going to turn out to be reversed. And a lot of the success we've seen is going to be reversed. So I think that if there's one sort of hopeful message or one message to think about when you're deciding how to vote in 2020, it would be that one.
The book is Clear and Present Safety: The World Has Never Been Better and Why That Matters to Americans. Michael A. Cohen, thanks so much for being on New Books in Politics.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.